This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight:
at least 17 people have been admitted for injuries sustained Wednesday in the opposition stronghold of Kisumu as demonstrators demanding electoral reforms clash with police. Police deny using live bullets.
That was Mohamed Yusuf reporting from Kisumu. We'll have details coming up.
Also, one of Liberia's leading political parties wants to put the results of the country's presidential election on hold. And Congo's election commission says the nation's long-delayed presidential election will not happen until sometime in 2019.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story: Kenya's electoral board says a repeat of the August presidential election will be open to all 8 original candidates. The poll had been annulled by the Supreme Court and is now scheduled to be repeated on October 26th. The commission, known as the IEBC, says main opposition candidate Raila Odinga is still on the ballot because it has not received his official withdrawal from the election. Odinga announced a day earlier he is no longer running. A day after Odinga announced his intentions, protesters took to the streets in Nairobi demanding that President Uhuru Kenyatta step down. Kenya has been in electoral limbo since the original results were nullified on September 1st due to what the Supreme Court called irregularities and illegalities.
At least 17 people have been admitted for injuries sustained yesterday in the opposition stronghold of Kisumu as demonstrators demanding electoral reform clashed with police. Police deny using live bullets. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
Lucas Otieno is in pain and his bed is soaked in blood. The 24-year-old boat welder says he was caught in the Wednesday demonstrations in Kisumu in western Kenya on his way to work. Before I got to my place of work, I met police officers at the bridge. They started throwing tear gas, then people started running. I stopped at the Kondele market, then I felt pain. I touched, then I saw blood. A bullet hit his genitals and lodged in his groin. He says Otieno's father, Moses Odingo, is angered by his son's injuries.
You cannot have a situation where you just shoot aimlessly at helpless people who are not even involved in the demonstrations. And Kisumu now has become like the Wild West, where people are learning to shoot.
Opposition supporters clash with police in the Kondele area in Kisumu County. Families of the injured and protesters have accused the police of using live bullets to quell the riots, an accusation denied by the police. In the main hospital in Kisumu, few doctors and nurses are available to attend to the injured, some of whom have been here for hours without treatment. Eloko Thiamba, who sells second-hand clothes, says police assaulted him at his place of work. I was hiding in my shop. Police were chasing some of the demonstrators and they realized someone was hiding in the shop. They entered and started beating me with a baton. They broke my left hand and I have not got treatment. I was told to come back tomorrow. Odhiambo was one of the dozens of injured waiting for treatment at the biggest hospital. Dr. Juliana Otieno works at the Jaramogi Odinga Hospital. She says they have received patients with serious injuries.
There were 23, by 6:30, and 3 were gunshot. The rest were other injuries. 3 were gunshot, the rest were other injuries. Yeah, they got treatment. One or two was to go to theater, so they were still being prepared. The gunshots are the ones that were to go to theater.
Political tensions continue to climb in Kenya ahead of the rerun presidential election on October 26th. Opposition supporters took to the streets of major cities Wednesday to demand that electoral officials who were blamed for irregularities in the August election step down immediately. On Tuesday, opposition leader and presidential candidate Raila Odinga pulled out of the October polls, citing grievances with the Electoral Commission and President Uhuru Kenyatta's ruling party. The opposition has vowed to continue with the protests till their demands are met. Opposition supporters say they will take to the streets for more demonstrations. But for Lucas Otieno, the welder, a long night awaited him at the hospital as doctors prepare to remove the bullet. He likely has a long road to recovery ahead. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Kisumu, Kenya.
One of Liberia's leading political parties called for a halt in announcing the result of Tuesday's presidential election, citing irregularities in the vote. The Liberty Party said it would consider taking legal action if the National Elections Commission, NEC, did not act in on its demands. Liberty Party candidate Charles Brumskine was considered a front-runner to take over from Nobel Peace Prize winner Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. The NEC is expected to release preliminary results today. The party's national chairman, Benjamin Sanvee, said the Liberty Party is deeply troubled by the discovery of numerous incidents of irregularities and fraud that occurred during the elections. He did not give specific evidence of fraud, and it was unclear what kind of activity could have altered Tuesday's vote. An NEC spokesman told Reuters that it was unaware of the Liberty Party's complaint and did not say whether the commission believed illegal acts occurred.
Congo's Election Commission says the nation's long-delayed presidential election will not happen until sometime in 2019. The commission said yesterday it is still conducting voter registration in the troubled remote Kasai region and needs an additional 504 days to organize the election once that process is complete. The presidential race has spawned deadly protests in the capital, Kinshasa. Opposition groups have risen up against President Joseph Kabila, who remained in power after his second term ended last December.
The International Organization for Migration says there has been a dramatic drop in the number of migrants from West Africa crossing the Sahel region into Niger on their way to Europe. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
Migration officials attribute the drop in African migration to strong action by the government of Niger against human smuggling networks. The International Organization for Migration reports Niger has closed 3 of 6 transit houses in the town of Agadez, where migrants often stop on their journey. IOM Niger Chief of Mission Giuseppe Lopret says migrants used to wait in the houses for smugglers' vehicles to take them to Algeria or Libya.
Many vehicles have been withdrawn by the army along the migratory routes. Smugglers have been arrested. So all these created a context, sent across a message that transiting Agadez is not easy, is not that easy.
Lopret tells VOA fewer migrants are arriving and staying in Agadez because of the difficulty in finding smugglers to take them to North Africa.
Last year, the first 6 months, we were estimating 5,000 to 7,000 migrants transiting per week going to Algeria or Libya. Right now, our numbers show that we have 5,500 migrants per month transiting, so there's definitely less migrants.
While the Agadez route is drying up, Loprat says, migration to Europe is not. He says smugglers are finding alternate, possibly more dangerous routes to transport their human cargo. He says Africans desperate to carve out a better life for themselves in Europe continue to risk their lives, making the perilous journey across the Sahel and eventually across the Sahara Desert. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. With Yehia Swuhi, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Police in Zimbabwe arrested and assaulted street vendors today. The vendors defied an order from President Robert Mugabe to close up shop to make way for pedestrians and traffic. It's the latest sign of rising tensions over the country's ailing economy. Sebastian Mofu has more from Harare.
Ah! In the streets of Harare on Thursday, vendors selling fruits, herbs, second-hand clothes and other items did business as usual, defying an order from the government to shut down. VOA saw police assault and arrest some vendors. However, as soon as they left, other vendors put their goods on the streets and carried on with their sales. Police chased Simon Manomwe from his usual spot outside a post office. He says he and other traders are trying to earn a living. If they are chasing us away from selling fruits in the streets, where do they want us to go? This is how we are living. This is how we earn our children's fees, he says. Samuel Wadzai is the director of the National Vendors Union of Zimbabwe. He says vendors will continue to resist President Robert Mugabe's order.
The vendors are not criminals, and these are people who are just trying to make a living in this very harsh economic circumstances, which the same government created. So they should sober up, and we are not living because we go back home, we are going to die of hunger.
The Southern African nation is going through its worst economic slump since the hyperinflation of 2008 led to Zimbabwe abandon its own dollar. An acute shortage of American dollars and South African rand has prompted shops to hike the price of most commodities. Businesses say the cost of importing goods has gone up as they try to find foreign currency on the black market. Bond notes, a surrogate currency introduced last year, officially trades on par with the US dollar, but lately it is trading at just 50% of its official value. Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights said it has deployed attorneys to represent informal traders who were arrested Thursday, with the unemployment rate estimated to be as high as 85%. Informal trading has become the order of the day in Zimbabwe, but even the street vendors are struggling.
No, it has obtained yes, but these days are very low.
33-year-old Tinashe Gombiro says, "I've been selling wares in the streets for 4 years now. Business has gone down now because of the cash shortages. Most people want to use debit cards or mobile money transactions when buying. If I were to accept that, it would be difficult to restore," he says. President Mugabe has lashed out in the face of criticism and recent street protests over the economy. Last month, he accused some members of the ruling party of being, quote, saboteurs, unquote, and urging businesses to raise prices to foment revolt ahead of elections next year. Mugabe says he will stand for another term in those elections. By then, the long-time Zimbabwean leader will be 94 years old. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
South Africa is battling an avian influenza outbreak. The government has introduced relief measures for affected farmers, but over 2 million birds have already died or been culled. It's the biggest outbreak of avian influenza in the country's recent history. The cases are all in the Western Cape, and it is costing the poultry industry millions of dollars. Nadia Same reports from Johannesburg.
Local farmers are distraught. Many watch their poultry stock and their livelihoods diminish before their eyes. 70 ostrich farms are currently under quarantine. 36 cases of the deadly H5N6 virus have been confirmed. The industry is reeling. Alan Wind is the Western Cape Minister of Economic Opportunities. He says a humanitarian relief plan is being drafted to help affected farmers.
The easiest way to explain it is we've got 29 million chickens, and 2 million of that 29 have been culled or have died as a result of this avian influenza. direct cost is about 800 million rand to that industry itself. And of course, that has a knock-on effect and a multiplier effect.
The virus was first detected locally in June. Since then, millions of birds have been culled and their carcasses composted to prevent further spread of the virus. One farm, Windmill Eggs, has lost 70% of its flock. It's left staff at the 40-year-old family business devastated. The government is trying to cushion the blow for companies like this one.
So we've put together a joint operations command. We're treating it as a disaster, so we put the same mechanisms in place where we bring together environmental affairs, because where the chickens having to be culled have to be composted, and obviously they're infected, so they have to be treated that we don't spread the infection. We've got social development involved and the Department of Labor, because obviously in specifically the smaller poultry farms, when a whole farm loses all of its poultry, there's pressure put on jobs. So we're having to look at the social net. We've got obviously the vets. We have vets that are on the farms all the time. They're part of the Joint Operations Command, local government, because it spreads across all of government. We then feed through to national government. So we treat it very seriously. We've put this broad kind of program together to try and make sure we manage it as best as we can, and put quarantines in place, especially in the ostrich industry where we don't cull. And of course, ostriches don't die from the bird flu generally. They get it, you know, we try and, you know, get them to work through it. But it's the quarantining in place. So we put quite strict management controls to make sure that we contain this as best we can. But of course, that's difficult because it gets spread via wild birds, it gets spread by the wind. So it is not that easy to manage.
Additional health and safety measures are being put in place at all farms in the province in a bid to curb the spread. The minister says humans are not at risk of contracting the virus.
So far across the world, there's been no case of this strain of avian influenza spreading from birds to humans. So that risk is not there. But of course, we treat it because it's a highly contagious influenza. So obviously on farm, we make sure that there's a lot of disinfectant. We make sure that people are not overly exposed. You know, we really try to manage it as you would manage any virus. So there's quite strict protocols in place. But of course, that is to also manage the spread of the virus from, you know, one farm to another, more so than, you know, making sure that it doesn't spread to humans, because we haven't had any cases. But we also treat it seriously and make sure we deal with it in the same way that you would deal with any virus.
The local government's also quick to point out there is some light at the end of the tunnel.
Also seen in the last month, we had 200 culls a month ago. Now we're sitting at 2 million. So you can see it is serious. But of course, we've also got some advantages, because as it gets warmer, we're moving from winter into summer. Like any flu virus we know within humans, that you're more susceptible in wintertime. We hopefully are now, with the warmer weather, going to see a drop in these cases.
While this avian flu outbreak is estimated to set back the industry to the tune of 800 million rand, that's around 60 million US dollars, the long-term costs are expected to run into billions. And there's a knock-on effect. The price of eggs and meat are expected to increase in response to the disaster, and low-income households are sure to be worst affected. This is Nadia Sami for VOA Africa, Johannesburg.
The U.S. State Department said today the United States will leave UNESCO at the end of the year because of what Washington considers its anti-Israel bias. Washington also has concerns about its mounting financial arrears and need for reforms. UNESCO Director General Irina Bokova expressed profound regret at the U.S. decision. The U.S. stopped funding UNESCO in 2011 after members voted to admit Palestinians. Congress passed a law in the 1990s banning U.S. support for organizations that grant membership to the Palestinians. However, the U.S. remained a member of the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. Now it will take observer status. The U.S. withdrew from UNESCO before, in 1984, saying it needed significant reforms. After changes began in 1999, Washington rejoined the body in 2003. UNESCO's mission is to promote peace through cooperation in education, science, and cultural development. It has an annual budget of more than $630 million.
Negotiators for the rival Palestinian Fatah and Hamas factions signed an agreement in Cairo today, sealing a reconciliation deal which has eluded the parties during multiple rounds of talks since a 2007 split. As Edward Iranian reports from Cairo, the move comes after 3 days of discussions under the auspices of Egyptian intelligence officials.
Top Palestinian negotiators from the Fatah and Hamas factions smiled and shook hands under the watchful gaze of Egyptian officials as they agreed to a reconciliation deal following a 10-year schism. Fatah's lead negotiator, Azem Ahmed, told reporters after the ceremony that the agreement's key element is the resumption of control by a Palestinian unity government over Gaza.
He
says the parties have agreed that the legitimate Palestinian unity government will function normally, taking up its official role according to the law. Hamas lead negotiator Salah Azouri maintained that it was in the interest of both sides to end their dispute. He says that we are part of the same family and we share the same destiny. So when we put our hands in each other's hands, we are helping ourselves. And our only choice is to continue to move toward unity and achieve the aspirations of our people. Egyptian media reported that Hamas had agreed to hand over control of the Rafah border crossing to both Palestinian Authority security forces and European Union monitors as per a 2005 agreement with Israel. Palestinian Authority security forces will also be deployed alongside Hamas forces inside Gaza. Egypt and Israel will then step up fuel supplies to Gaza's main power plant to ease an electricity crisis. Hilal Kashan, who teaches political science at the American University of Beirut, tells VOA he thinks the Palestinian reconciliation deal is part of the global strategy by the Trump administration to reach a peace deal between the Arab states and Israel. For that to happen, though, he argues that key Arab states like Saudi Arabia must find a face-saving solution to the conflict that they can present to their own people.
The Saudis want peace with Israel. They want to recognize Israel. They want to create an anti-Iranian alliance. And the only way to do it is to end the Israel-Palestine conflict so that they can look good in the eyes of their own people.
Fatah official Zakaria Aga told Arab media that Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas is expected to visit Gaza within the coming month to seal the reconciliation deal. Another round of talks between Fatah and Hamas is expected to take place in Cairo before the end of October to decide on the logistics of holding expected presidential and parliamentary elections next year. Arab media also reported that Israeli officials met with their Egyptian counterparts during the negotiations to press Hamas to agree to a prisoner swap. It was not immediately clear if any agreement was reached. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.